Never work for anyone you don't like or respect. In 18 months' time, if I was unsuccessful, I'd have been out on the streets. My family's been the reason I've been allowed to do what I do in radio.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. John Myers.
I hated school, so I got out as soon as I can. I got a job in the council. I remember going to this youth club and there was a guy on there playing records. And I remember he had the foul disco deck and the lights and everything else that went with it. He was getting £4 a night. I was cleaning cars for a local garage. That was what my job was. And I was getting 12 quid a week. And this guy was getting 4 quid for playing records for a few hours. So I got chatting to him and I was amazed by it. And I really didn't have anything. I loved my music, but I didn't really know what discos were about. And he got 4 quid and I thought, that's not a bad job to try and do. I can actually still remember the mic, and it was a Shure. And I hadn't spoken on the microphone whatsoever, and I remember the moment I spoke on the mic, I boomed out. I actually didn't recognise myself. I thought, wow, this is something. I managed to go on and on to my dad about this is the job I should get. And I remember he paid 200 quid to Roger Squires, who's everybody's bought equipment from Roger Squires over the years. And I bought a twin deck, couple of speakers and some basic lights, and I was off doing discos. And it was at that time that I started then to pay attention to microphone techniques, and the only way I could find out about that was actually to listen to the radio.
Looking at the weather, word dropping to -5 degrees centigrade. Western Britain will be cloudy with rain or sleet.
I was on nightclubs till about 1 o'clock, and I'd come out, I would tune in to Radio Luxembourg, and there was a guy there who always did the closing announcement for Radio Luxembourg. And I used to sit in my Vauxhall Opel 1.2. He would showbiz it up and he would say things. I can still remember it now. He'd say things broadcasting, Radio Luxembourg, broadcasting on 1,200,000 watts.
This is Radio Luxembourg, the world's biggest independent commercial radio station. Broadcasting on 208 meters, 1439 kilohertz, medium wave with an omnidirectional power of 1,200,000 watts.
And right at the end, good night, good morning, wherever you may be.
And a good night and good morning, wherever you may be.
And I used to say, good night, Bob. And then go into bed. But it was the tone of that man that I really liked. And then I got a job at Radio Carlisle, as it was then, Radio Cumbria now, and I was the tech op, and I had to go in for the breakfast show. A guy called Ray Moore was on Radio 2, and Radio Carlisle at that time used to take, as all BBC local stations did, they used to take Radio 2 through the night. And he was a fantastic jock. He had wonderful voice, just wonderful diction.
I was sitting here September the 30th, 1967, that's right, 5:30 in the morning with a programme called Breakfast Special. 20 years on, 5:30 in the morning, sitting here. What a wonderful progress in my career.
I used to have to play a tape in that Ray Moore had sent round all of the BBC stations. And as the record was halfway through, you'd have to play this tape in and he'd say, "This is Ray Moore. Time for me to say goodbye now." And hand you over to Radio Carlisle. And I used to think, good grief, we're going from someone brilliant like this to talking about sheep. One of the producers, a guy called David Lamb, came into the nightclub where I was working and said, "Hey, John, there's a job going as a tech op at Radio Carlisle. Why don't you put in for it?" I thought, "That'd be great, that, David." He said, "But one tip, if I can give you, when you go for the interview, do not say you want to be on air, because they don't want those people. They want people who's really good at helping others do what they do on air," which was a bit of a disappointment, I have to say, but it was a way in. And I went for the interview, and a guy called Mike Gibbons, who's very well known in BBC local radio, he interviewed me. I liked him straight away, big bushy beard. And he said to me, that point came in the interview, "John, have you any ambitions to be on the air? I said, oh, no, absolutely not. I said, I'd like to make people as good as they can be behind the scenes. Lying through my teeth, of course. And anyway, he gave me the job, and I was a part-time tech op. I'd even go in on my days off when I wasn't getting paid just to learn everything there was to know. And then I was only in there, I think, 3 weeks when they came to me and they asked me to do the country show. And I hate country music. I've always disliked it. But, of course, it was a chance to get on air. So I managed to go on and do that show as the best I could. I played anything with a steel guitar, anything, and used to ask people, you know, what was country music.
I love you because you understand it.
And I used to go in through the night when it was closed down, and I'd do demo tape after demo tape, and I'd send it out, and these are the times you'd send little 5-inch reels of tape out. I sent this off to a guy called Keith Macklin at Red Rose, who was an absolutely lovely man, but probably the worst program organizer I've ever come across in my life. But I sent it to him. I got a letter back saying, thanks very much, but you're not quite what we're looking for. I don't know why you used to get letters like that, because they never explained what they were looking for. And I remember getting that tape, and I thought, I'm going to listen to that again to see what it is that they don't quite like. And I remember listening back to the tape, and to my horror, I had sent them a blank tape. And then it struck me that Keith Macklin hadn't even listened to my tape and sent me that letter. So I remember ringing his PA up, and his PA, I remember her to this day, because her name was Innes Bracegirdle. And I remember ringing Innes up, complaining that they'd sent me this letter and they hadn't even listened to the tape. And she put me straight through to Keith, and Keith was really embarrassed and invited me down for an interview, which is where I wanted to do in the first place. And he invited me down, and when I was down there, a couple of weeks later, he gave me the weekend shows.
Lancashire's first independent local radio station.
Red Rose Radio in the early 80s was an absolute joy. Fantastic presenters on, full of personality, Baz Riley, Dave Lincoln doing mid-morning, the housewife's choice, and this station was brand new, in a church, so that was unique, run by a guy called David Maker, who was the most difficult MD I've ever come across in my life, hated presenters, believe it or not, hated presenters, at least I thought he did. He ran the station, though, to his credit, really well. I just loved being there. You could do things on the air. You could find yourself, be right up there and create some personality. And, of course, this is a station that had 60, 68% reach in those early days. So, you know, just about everybody was listening to you. I remember in those days, they used to determine how successful you were as a presenter, because they didn't really have a lot of research. So David Maker came up with this idea that he'd count your mail, which I couldn't believe. And so every morning, the receptionist used to have to count your mail. I remember we'd do competitions and you'd say, send it in on the back of a sealed-down envelope. Depending on how much mail you got, David Maker would form a view about how well-liked you were by the listeners. And so I, along with many others, I think Derek Webster was another, we just put ourselves on as many mailing lists as we could get. They brought out this thing because they didn't have Selector back then, so they didn't have, you know, computer programming. And they were just bringing in a sort of playlist, which I rarely kept to, which used to annoy everybody. We went to a presenters meeting. Again, that wasn't something that happened a lot in those days. But at this meeting, they presented something called a clock on a piece of paper that had been... Someone done it with felt pen and things like that, and it worked out, obviously, around the clock what you might do across the hour. So it might be an A-list song here, a C-list song there, B-list there. I was doing Weekend Breakfast, and they had this thing at 8:10, and they'd written in it, funny link. And they wanted you to do a funny link at that time. I looked at that, and I just couldn't believe it. Well, I cannot be funny to order. I certainly can't be funny as per the link on a clock. I came off air one day, and the boss pulled me in and said, John, it's what happened this morning? I said, what do you mean, what happened? He said, 8:10. There was no funny link. I said, I just couldn't think of one. I said, however, I was absolutely hilarious at 10 to 8 and more than madly amusing at 25 past 8. But in those days, a lot of the managers in radio weren't actually presenters. So they used to manage in the old colonial style.
More snap, less crackle, lots more pop.
Good morning.
Red Rose Radio.
So after a time at Red Rose, I really thought, you know, I can do a bit more of this. But I only really wanted to be on the air. I had no intention whatsoever to be in management because the management I was receiving from people like David Maker always used to look quite vicious. He would walk by the window of the studio and he would never look in. He would never look in. And I remember going to the toilet once and he shouted to me, "Stand outside!" So I wasn't allowed to go in and have a pee next to him in the urinal. Because he was the boss. Suddenly this opportunity came to be a programme manager. So they were splitting the frequencies and Red Rose Rock was about to go on the air, Rock FM as it was called, and Red Rose Gold. Dave Lincoln asked me to manage Red Rose Gold and Rock FM went to a guy called Mark Matthews. The jingles they got for Rock FM, I was so jealous.
Rock in the Northwest.
And the reason it was called Rock FM, of course, as I'm sure many people know, is that they were about to move the radio station, Rock FM, to Blackpool. And right at the last minute, they decided that they weren't going to do that. So they just kept the name and it was broadcast from the church. And when the audience figures came out, Red Rose Gold was the biggest station in the whole of Lancashire and far more popular than the FM. It was a very special moment, and it was that moment, I think, that made me think, well, maybe I'm not too bad at this management lark. Although I was, I think it's fair to say, slightly aggressive as a manager then than I am now. I just kept the heritage of Red Rose Radio because I thought, here is a very successful station. Why do I need to change it? It's going to be called Red Rose Gold. I'll keep everything that's good about it, and I will go and find new presenters. We've had some heritage presenters, of course. Derek Webster, Dave Lincoln still stayed on Red Rose Gold, and myself, and I had to go and find some different presenters. And I remember at night time, because we were on AM, it would go very crackly at night, as all AMs used to do. And I thought, how do I compete with that? How do I make people want to tune in to AM on a crackly device, 301 metres, late at night? And I thought, what I need is a phone-in. But I need a phone-in with a difference. We'd already had Alan Bezick, who was synonymous for his phone-in, but he was on FM and AM. So I had to create something different. I met a guy called Colin Lamont. And Colin Lamont, I met some years earlier when I was on television. And he had this crazy personality. And I remember phoning him up and said, "Colin, you're obnoxious. You're not frightened to say something. Why don't you come down here? I'm going to try and make you a late-night phone-in." I wanted Colin to be the star and for his opinions to matter more than anything and for the callers to come on and challenge him. But also, most importantly, it had to be a fun phone-in. And eventually, people would very quickly realise that he was generally, usually always taking the mic. And I remember a couple of nights before the phone-in started, I thought, I can't have a phone-in guy called Colin. That's not peculiar enough. That's not something that people will remember. Colin. So what I decided to do, I remember I went to the ABC Miners. And anyone who's listening to this, Dave, will remember the ABC Miners. They used to have a jingle themselves. And the ABC Miners used to go, "We are the boys and girls well known as the Miners of the ABC." And in Carlisle, the guy used to do it was a guy called Scotty McClue. I pinched his name, Scott, and I just called it Scotty McClue, and he was an enormous success.
Along last night, seeing about three illegitimate children.
Well, she did have three illegitimate children. She had three little bastards.
Well, I don't think that's right, Scotty.
No, it's fact, darling. It is right. I'm telling you.
I mean, I don't think...
You know, we live in a world now where everyone seems to be able to complain. And they complain about things, and management these days are just not trained or at that point to deal with complaints. I once had a presenter who bragged to me that he's never had a complaint. And he had loads of complaints. And I said to him, you have had loads of complaints about you, but I've just never told you. And the reason I've never told you is because I never agreed with the complaints. And managers these days often go to the presenters or the talent with the complaints when they don't agree with them themselves.
I'm Bob Stewart. I'm Red Rose Gold. Listen, we're going to pause for the cause. When we come back, Cupid's inspiration.
There used to be a lady at Red Rose called Ilo. And Ilo used to come down and try and get me to put on air some of the craziest ideas that had been dreamt up by the sales team, or even worse, by the clients. And they would come in, and once a week we'd have a meeting, and they'd say, oh, listen, we've got this local tile manufacturer, and we wonder, John, if you can do a competition to give away a box of tiles. I went, no. Not to. Who the hell wants a box of tiles? So what I said was, look, why don't you give me the client, and I'll come back with the idea. So I said, I'll do the creative, you find me the client. And very often I would go to the sales team and I would find out which clients are spending money, who's open to ideas. And I come up with crazy competitions. And we had things like the holiday game, and which was actually a lot of my stuff. I don't mind admitting it, a bit like a blackbird. A lot of my stuff I just nicked from people who were doing it elsewhere. So I put them on the air and refine them a little bit. And I think that was the trick of a great PD, is just to refine them for your market. And we go on there and have fun with them. And instead of little bits of competitions, we decided to have big competitions that ran across the whole day. I used to get £25 a shift for working on Red Rose. And I'd have to travel all the way down from Carlisle down to Lancashire. I'd spend £20 on petrol, and I made a fiver for often doing a four-hour show. But I loved it, so it wasn't really about the money, and somehow you just managed to survive. My wife was working, I was working, but you know, at the time my wife was making more than me. But it was the career I wanted to forge in some way. And I remember sitting at home, and I was watching the television, and the ITV network at that time, they had people coming up in between the programmes. And they'd say, hello, this is Tyne Tees. Coming up next, Coronation Street. I watched that and I thought, I can do that. I can do that. Goodness me. And so I decided to plague the boss at Border Television. This guy's name was called Eric Hadwin. And I rang him every single Monday. In fact, one Monday they rang me because I hadn't rang them to see if I was all right. So anyway, I rang up this one day thinking just be another, yes, John, good to hear from you. Sorry, but there's nothing. And I rang up one day and they said, John, so happy you called. We've got a three-day contract for you. Why don't you come in? So I had no screen test. I went in to Border Television. I went in and my first piece to camera was 6 minutes. And it was called the Border Diary, which was just a what's on diary, but you had to read it to camera. And I remember the technical guy came to me and says, right, you're going to come out of this at 9:25. I went, yeah. And you've got to shut up, he said, and say goodbye by 9:30:50. I went, yeah. Of course, I'd been on radio by this time, and talking to Time, anyone who'd been on radio, this is a doddle. I thought, I don't understand what the fuss is about. And they were so impressed, they actually gave me then a 3 month contract, which then went on for 3 years.
This is Border Television, broadcasting to Cumbria, South Scotland, the Isle of Man, and North and West Northumberland.
So Border Television was this wonderful ITV station, making good money, but not great money. And they knew that the future had to be by expanding into something, and they had decided to expand into radio. I'd already moved back to Red Rose then because I really missed the liveliness and the immediacy of radio. So I was back at Red Rose. And Border TV had decided to put in for regional licenses. And before that, there I was at Red Rose. I get this call saying, John, we're launching a radio station in Carlisle, your hometown. It's called Carlisle Radio Limited. Would you come and launch it? And I thought, well, hang on a minute. I'm at Red Rose. I'm doing the breakfast show. I'm the program director. I'm doing very well, thank you. And they had a population of over 1 million. They want me to go back to Carlisle with a population of 150,000. I said, well, look, I don't really want to do it, but I'll come and give you some advice. I remember going up to see them. Scottish Radio were involved, and I went into this meeting, and I told them how to do it. And they said, John, you're absolutely right, so why don't you do it? And I said, well, I couldn't possibly. I said, you can't afford me. And there was this classic thing happened at the board where I sort of put them in a corner, because what happened is they gave me the budget, and I looked at this budget. And I said, look, there is a way you can afford me, and if I can show you a way of how you can afford me, would you be prepared to go with that? And they said, well, if you can show us a way, I said, dead easy. You've got a salary here for the breakfast show. You've got a salary here for the MD. I'll have both. You can afford me. And the reason I went to launch CFM was because, A, it was my hometown, and B, I'd never launched a station before. I'd managed it, but I'd never launched it.
It's rather like the look-around newsroom. Chaos, but organised chaos. But a hectic day for you, John.
It certainly has been a hectic day, Eric. We've had hundreds and hundreds of phone calls. We've had faxes galore. We even had one today off the Prime Minister, who sent us good-luck messages, which I thought was very nice, considering all his problems at the moment.
And so CFM became this enormous success. Very quickly, it had a 58% reach. And Border had put in for this regional licence in Newcastle, and they'd also put in for a regional licence in Scotland. That was called Scott FM. And they'd put in for this one in the northeast called Northeast Radio. They asked me if I'd run it, if they won it. So I had a look at the application. It was the biggest pile of dog's dinner you've ever seen. I mean, they had a thing called, you know, the Whippet 100. They had this thing called the Tatey Pot. It was just the worst application in the world. But to be fair to them, they put the North East application together as a dry run for winning the Scotland one. Anyway, they won the North East. They asked me to go and do it. And I said I would go and do it as long as I can go to the radio authority at the time and just have a word with them about this application. And I went down to see Paul Brown, I think it was at the time, and had a chat with him about this application. And I said, listen, can we agree that the speech elements of the application is just an example of the speech elements, not the speech elements that we have to do? And I remember Paul saying, John, absolutely, but not a moment or a second too much music. You can't play more than 45% music. We got into so much trouble all the time about the levels of speech. Metro Radio were so frightened of us that they commissioned someone to do nothing but listen to us all day, every day, and calculate how much speech we were doing. It got to a point where if I didn't talk long enough in the morning, John Simons on drive time had to talk more in the afternoon. We used to get people on and talk to them for ages. I remember doing competitions. I had them on in any half hour. They might be on 20 minutes of it. And this is where I think formats are dangerous and where they can be really helpful. If I didn't have a strict format as I had at Century, I'm not so sure I would have created the kind of radio that would have made it as successful as it became. And we decided to do speech by being very community-based and reflecting the humour and the passion that they had for the Northeast. So we had football, we had competitions, and we had this thing called a crazy gardening show on a Sunday, which was 2 hours of gardening. And the reason it was called crazy is it never talked about gardening. I learned so much from being restricted about what you could do and how you can make speech work that brings an audience in.
Barbara Streisand and A Star Is Born. A very good morning to you. This is John Morgan and welcome to Century.
And I would talk about the competition. And this sort of spooked them a great deal at Metro, because I would talk about them. I'd get a listener to come on air. And if they were a really bad caller sometimes, because we used to put them on air, sometimes we put them on air at breakfast time. We didn't even know who they were. Just opened the lines. People would love it because it was quite dangerous. And if the caller was really bad, I'd say, listen, I don't know how you've got through here. Shouldn't you be listening to Metro? They're the boring ones. You should go and listen to them. That was actually quite new at the time, that you would actually physically promote them by being a little bit negative about them. that was just one of the things we used to do. We got the commentary for Middlesbrough Football Club. We hired a great commentator called Alistair Brown, who sadly recently just passed away, probably one of the best commentators of all. And we used to say to Ali, Ali, when you go on air, I do not care about you being impartial. Go on air, promote Borough, sound like a fan on the air, and do not give a toss about anyone listening who might not be from the Borough. Just be really positive about your team. And of course, he took that to excess. And again, we became really famous for it. But it was certainly a radio station of its time. And it was certainly attracting audience, because our listening figures were very good. It was certainly attracting revenue, and it was certainly annoying the hell out of our competitors, which I greatly loved. And the stunts we got up to many times against Metro became very well known over the years.
Scott FM was launched in September 1994, and behind all the razzmatazz was a simple aim: to target an audience of aspirational Scots between 24 and 44 by playing the music they loved and by providing them with
brilliant.
The information they required.
That moment there, they had a very vociferous local press in Edinburgh as well. And of course, Radio Clyde and Sir Jimmy and all those sort of people, were all in their pockets. And they were very anti-Scott FM at the time. And I think the times and the things that went on there, I felt sorry for the team. But they did sort of set themselves up, because they announced that they were a Scottish kind of Radio 4. Well, we never said that about Century. We were certainly never going to be a North East Radio 4. We were a personality station and proud of it. And we didn't really care. That was the impression that we gave. And of course, and then when they put Scotty McClue on the air, I think the agencies thought, well, you aren't what you say you are. But it was successful to a point. Border Television was a shareholder then, along with Scottish TV. You know, things just didn't go as well as it could do, and certainly not as well as Century was doing. We were going to put a licence in for the North West Manchester, the biggest radio licence outside London, the population of over 5 million. And we were dillying and dallying, and we hadn't put a licence together. And it was only about 4 or 6 weeks ago or something like that. And the board said, John, why aren't we going for the North West licence? I said, why? There's loads of them in. I mean, I think at the time there was over 20 applications. And in those days, you had to go and get the great and the good to be on your board, and also to provide loads and loads of letters of support. I said, we haven't done any of that. I said, and I remember this lady called Kath Worrell, who actually came in and said, listen, I'll write the application, we'll get it together. And we decided to put an application in right at the last minute. That application had some research in, of course, but it had no letters of support. We put a board together very quickly. But it certainly, in terms of quality, was not as good as nearly all of the others. I remember when the applications were published, I went through them all. And I put a paper to my board and I said, in terms of us versus the rest, we're probably second bottom. In terms of chances to win, we're probably in the top three. They said, hey, because, you know, the board at that time, a board of television, was Lord this and Lady that. I said, Joe, how could you say that? I said, well, because Century's doing very well and there's a lot of competition in the Northwest. I think we'll be up against two or three other licensees. I thought it was going to be between me, another one by Chrysalis, I think Heart FM at the time, and one more that had a very big board on it. They used to ring you at 5 o'clock, but if you'd won, they'd always ring you a couple of minutes before 5 o'clock. I was sitting at my desk, and suddenly the white phone, which was my direct line, rang at 3 minutes to 5. And it was David Vick. And I picked the phone up. I said, hello. I can remember, this is one of the greatest moments of my life. And it was David Vick. He went, hello, John. I says, hello, David. How are you? I thought, why is he asking me how I am? He's really, you know, just get on with it. And he went, John, good news. You've just won the biggest radio license outside of London. Congratulations. Well, I'll tell you, I absolutely erupted. And to win that license against the competition was enormous. And it was only a few years later when someone who was at the Radio Authority at the time said to me, it came down to this, John. It was you and Heart FM, Chrysalis, on the table at the end. And it was put to the board, here is an adult contemporary radio station with great music, or here is an adult contemporary radio station with speech. And they went, oh, let's go for that. That's what happened, and it was one of the most joyous moments of my life. I nearly ran across the time bridge. I was that excited.
Good morning. You're listening to Century 105 on Tuesday, September the 8th. It's 8 a.m. and a star is born.
John Simons had gone off to work at Talk Radio, so I had a new programme director called Graham Ledger. But I was pretty much running everything. And I decided, again, I needed a hook and we had to do some speech. So I hired a guy called Derek Hatton, Degsy, who everyone was 50-50 on. You either loved or hated Degsy.
Don't forget, we in Liverpool had had probably about 10, 15 years of a Liberal-Tory alliance that had ruined the city.
And, of course, that is the perfect combination if you're looking for a phone-in host. So I met Degsy, I liked him, and I decided to put him on at lunchtimes. But the night before, we had this big opening gala in the car park, and then we launched the next morning at 8 a.m. There was a lot of media around, a big media circus. And it was great to see. And I remember going on there, I launched the station at 8 o'clock, and they always started with a very famous song. All my stations have started with A Star Is Born. We started off with that, and the station kicked into air. And I couldn't wait for everyone to go because, you know, when you launch a station, you know you have to do something. You've got to launch it. You've got to have an event. But actually, what you desperately want is for everyone to sod off. So get out.
The Morgan Show. Century.
ELO and Sweet Talking Woman. Good morning, it's Century 105, the only station that's giving away.
And Border Television, of course. And then they had interest in Scott FM. They had the Century brand that they owned. And they also got an interest in Radio 106. And Radio 106 was based in Nottingham, run by an excellent, excellent operator called Ron Coles.
12 months later, it was given the go-ahead and the East Midlands was on the list. That's when I started working on the application to run it and assembling the team.
And for whatever reason, Radio 106 wasn't going well. They asked me if I would manage that. So at the time, I became the breakfast presenter at Century 105, Group MD of Border Radio Holdings, and I had to go and Radio 106, which of course we changed to Century. And then, of course, now it's Gem, of course, which is, I think Gem now is probably the best it's ever been. I was at the desk and I get a call from this woman who said that she's the executive producer for a BBC programme called Trouble at the Top. And Trouble at the Top went to businesses who were in trouble and filmed them sorting that trouble out. And they wanted to come and film us as we were launching Century 105 in Manchester. And Paul Cawley, who is a brilliant TV producer, was also the boss of Border Television at the time. So I sent a note through saying, listen, Trouble at the Top, listen, we haven't got much money because we're Border Television for marketing. I just see this as free marketing. So why don't we just do it? I remember Paul giving me a call going, John, this is not a good idea. This is not a good idea. They can edit this program to make you, and most importantly, make Century look bad. You know, we recommend you don't do it. And this is from the board. And I thought, oh, to hell with that. You know, I think I'll just do it anyway. So I decided I would do it subject to seeing the producer. So the producer came up to Manchester and we had a chat and I quite liked her. And I thought, I think I could charm her a little bit as we go along this process. And they started doing Trouble at the Top. And they signed a contract with me that said they could film the station and me and what goes on behind the scenes at any time, except they couldn't come into a board meeting or interviews or meetings of a private nature.
As well as setting up the new station, John is also in charge of Century 106, Nottingham. He's worried because their all-important audience figures are too low, and he's heading south to pay them a visit.
And I remember the producer came to me and said, John, we've got a problem. I said, what's the problem? Said, there's no trouble. And what this is turning out to be is a 40-minute advert for Century Radio and commercial radio, which is not what the program's about. So we need some trouble, or we need to find some trouble in order to film that to make the program more interesting. And I said, well, this is my fourth or fifth launch. If you'd been at my first one, there'd have been loads of trouble, but I've now got this pretty much organised. I said, however, I've just taken over Radio 106, and there's loads of trouble down there. So they expanded their brief to follow me to trying to sort out Century in the East Midlands, and that is when all the trouble started.
The old management has moved out, and John's moved in and sacked nearly all the presenters.
There's a new sound. And I walk in, say hello to the receptionist. As I'm walking up the stairs, I hear the receptionist say this, and my heart sunk as I climbed the stairs. And I heard her say, every time he comes, someone gets fired. And as I walked up the stairs and I walked into my office, and the producer came in and said, this is already looking positive, John. I said, yeah, well, there's things to do, but there might be a few more interesting things. I said, but ignore that receptionist. I don't think that's a very fair comment. I'd went out of the toilet. And as I came out of the toilet, this is probably the scene out of Trouble at the Top that people remember. And it was something that I regret to this day, the way it happened. But this is how it happened. And as I came out of the toilet, the producer of the religious programme was standing there. And she says, hello, John, can I have a word with you about the religious programme on a Sunday morning? And I went, today's not a good day. I've got the film crew here. The news I'm going to tell you isn't really great news, so we don't want that on camera. I said, so why don't you come back and see me tomorrow? So I was trying to give her an out. And she said, I'm perfectly capable of accepting bad news. I went, well, all right then. I said, well, give me 2 minutes and then come and knock on my door. So as I walked into my office, the film crew were on the floor and I said, right, start filming. And suddenly there was a knock at the door and this is what happened. The religious advisor came in and she sat down. And I said to her, right, listen, we've got good news and we've got bad news. The good news is I'm keeping God. The bad news is you're going. And then she just said, well, I'm really not very happy about that. I said, well, I'm sorry, but that's the way it's happening. And I said, the problem is, and the reason you're going, is that I showed her this Jikra page, which showed the audience. And I said, if you look at all that, they are the half-hour breakdowns on a Sunday morning. When you are on with your God slot, even God's not listening.
What you're doing now, at that particular time of day, nobody listens.
But that is a historical thing. That's not just because of the small role that I have on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, but what
that's
I'm saying...
because you're changing the whole thing.
Yeah, but your slot, when it goes out, nobody listens. I have an asterisk. And an asterisk at that time that the number of people who listen are so few they can't be counted. Mm.
And I looked over the shoulder and I could see the cameraman, their shoulders going up and down and the producer punching the air. I could see this in the background. And she said, well, that's terrible. I said, well, it's just business, I'm afraid. So we are going to keep our religious things because that's in our promise of performance, but we don't need a specific religious advisor to do that. So we are going to do it, but we're going to do it in a different way. I'm very sorry. And that's it. So she stormed out the door. And this is the moment that people remember. As she stormed out the door, my phone rang on the desk. And I looked at the camera crew and I said, this is God now.
He's God on the phone. Hello.
when I look back, that just wasn't a great way to manage that situation. I could have been kinder to her. I could have found a way, but she was so in my face about, oh, I can take bad news in front of a camera. I said, all right, let's see if you can. So I think I could have done it in a kinder way.
For Derbyshire, Leicestershire and Nottinghamshire, this is the East Midlands' biggest radio station. Century
106. Before the TV was, the share price was rising and I was just on a wage and I had no share options and they kept promising me share options and they wouldn't give me any. And I just saw the injustice of that. And in one day, it just came to a head. I think I'd been at the station by about 6 months. And remember, I had three jobs. I was group MD, I was the station MD, and I was also the breakfast presenter. And I was doing all of that, and I was travelling the country at our other stations, keeping abreast of what was going on there. I felt they were being unfair with me by not giving me a slice of the business. After all, I had created a great part of it. Anyway, we fell out. It was not a good fallout at all. We fell out quite badly. One day, I was in a real sulk. I'll be honest with you. I was in a real sulk. I felt down. I felt unloved at the time, and I very rarely felt bad. And I thought they should be doing something. And then one day, I just get this call. And this is where, you know, my dad died fairly early on in life, 60, 63 years of age. And I always think he's on my shoulder, just looking after me. And the phone went one day, and it was Sir Bob Phyllis from the Guardian Media Group. And Bob Phyllis had the TV on his hotel room. He'd been watching Trouble at the Top. They had been wanting to expand into radio. He gave me a call and said, look, John, would you come and see me? So I went to see him. This is John Myers from Carlisle, who left school with no education whatsoever, heading down to London to the Guardian Media Group HQ to see a guy who had been Deputy General of the BBC who wants to talk to me about radio. And he'd put in for some small licences, but had never won. I said, if you're going to get into it, I think you need to go for regional radio stations and you need to invest big. And he sat there and he went, John, you're absolutely right. Why don't you come and do it for us? And bear in mind, I was at that moment in quite a pit of despair about Border TV, where I had 10 fantastic years of my life. And I thought to myself, well, why not? And I did a contract with him. And people say that, you know, you do well in life. But actually, you often do well in life because of the risks. And here I was going to jump to the Guardian Media Group. And all they would give me was an 18-month contract. If I hadn't won a radio station in that 18 months, my contract came to an end. So in 18 months' time, if I was unsuccessful, I wouldn't have received anything. I'd have been out on the streets. I think life's a gamble. It sounded right. I absolutely loved him. I loved Bob Phyllis. He was supportive. He was kind. He'd give me a bollocking now and again. He gave me one or two bollockings along the way, but often did it with a smile. And he was hugely supportive. Often would just ring me up to ask how I was doing. There's a motto I have in life is never work for anyone you don't like or respect. And I did both for him. So I went and I joined. And probably the proudest moment of my life was going to Guardian Media Group. And I was on my own. Just me and a PA called Joanne, who'd been with me for 15, 16 years. And I started applying for the Wales license, South Wales. And even now, I have the application for South Wales, Real Radio South Wales, on my wall in a little glass container. It was a fantastic application. I put it in and we won the regional license. It's not unusual to be
loved by anyone. Good morning, South Wales. I'm Tom Jones. And good morning, Real Radio. You know, I'm really proud to introduce a great new radio station and I'm delighted to be the first person to welcome you.
The Guardian Media Group had never won anything in their lives. They created things, but they never actually won anything. This is the first time they'd won anything. So internally within GMG, my stock had risen tremendously. And Real Radio Wales, as has gone down in history now, was the most successful launch of a regional radio station anywhere in the country.
And a star is born.
It just took off. And the reason it took off is because I hired people who knew Wales. And I used to go down, I used to tell them what I wanted, I used to focus on them, I used to make sure they delivered what they did. Me and I got Simo back, so the team was back, and we went down, we lived in Wales, and we launched Real Radio Wales with Tom Jones and a couple of others, and Terry Underhill, he was doing breakfast, a great team, great sales team, and it became enormously successful. The board absolutely loved it, and they wanted to get more and more into radio. I remember the next station that came up was Yorkshire, and I was putting in for the Yorkshire licence, and suddenly I had to deal with this character that was very difficult, and that character was Kelvin McKenzie.
There's a reason that we're seeing
right
an increase in food banks.
Right,
I invite you to come with me. Come with me
struggling
to my local food bank, and
I'd
be more
no
than
idea.
Happy
You've
to show
no
you
idea.
The family.
Kelvin McKenzie had just come out The Sun, of course, and he was well known for being brash, opinionated, and a lot of people didn't like him. And I met Kelvin, and I liked him immediately. He made me laugh. He was just getting into radio. He'd bought a few radio stations, but he'd got too many, I think, and the bank wanted some of the money back. I went to see him, and I said, Kelvin, Scott FM, I'd like to buy Scott FM from you. He said, yeah, I'd like to sell it to you. I thought, great, let's just meet. He said, I'll organise something. I'll see you. I'll organise a meeting room. He organised a meeting room at the Savoy. The Savoy, we could have gone anywhere. We go to the Savoy. It's 500 quid an hour or whatever. And he tells me he wants 35 million quid for Scott FM. Scott FM at the time was losing £3 million a year. I said, I'd like to be 10 stone lighter, Kelvin. I said, it's not going to happen either. We're not going to pay you that. He said, how much will you pay me? I said, we'll pay you 20 million. He went, right, okay, deal. And that's it. We walked out. And I never heard from him for a few days. And when you don't hear from people, you know there's something amiss. But strangely, I hadn't heard anything from my good friend Phil Riley either. Phil Riley is probably my best friend in the whole of radio. We talk every couple of days, but Phil Riley went quiet. And I thought to myself, if Phil Riley's gone quiet, it's because he's after the same deal as I am. And then I couldn't get hold of Kelvin, so I knew something was going on. And I thought, well, we have to sort this out. Sir Bob Phillips came up with probably the best thing I have ever seen in business. He decided to write a letter to Barclays Bank, which was Kelvin's bank, saying that we were offering £25.5 million in cash, but that would end at 5 o'clock tomorrow evening, and we would not return. Chrysalis had offered, I think, £27 million or something like that, and Scottish Radio had offered £29 million. So clearly Kelvin wanted to take the highest bid. But the bank, as I understand it, was calling the tune then. Bob sent this letter to the boss of the bank. The bank then phoned Kelvin and told him that he had to accept our bid because we were cash, and the other two, because they were PLCs, had to get shareholder agreement. They may not get that shareholder agreement. So Bob, myself, and Nick Castro went to the lawyer's office, and we were sitting there on the Friday afternoon. We were waiting to see what would happen. And then the speakerphone burst into life, and it was Kelvin McKenzie. And Kelvin McKenzie says, are you there, John? I says, I am, Kelvin. Who's there with you? I said, we've got Sir Bob Phillips, and we've got Nick Castro, our FD. He went, right, I've done the deal. £25.5 million. You can have the station. Thanks very much, but you can all fuck off. And I said, I'm sorry, Kelvin. He said, you can fuck off. I said, John, I hope you enjoy it. I know you'll make a big thing of it. He said, but to sell to the Guardian Media Group is the lowest point in my life. So fuck off. And he put the phone down. Bob Phillips, who was brought up in a cosy atmosphere, has certainly never been told to fuck off in his life, was ashen-faced. He said, John, I don't believe it. We've just given him £25.5 million for a company that's not worth 10, and he's told us to fuck off. And we went out the building, but Bob was shaking his head as he was walking all the way back up Farringdon Road to his office. He hadn't been spoken like that in my life. I could see things were happening in the Guardian Media Group. We'd built the company up. We were doing well. And I remember we got an offer from Chrysalis Radio, and the offer was something like £125 million from Chrysalis. I go to the board, and the board said, "What do you think, John?" I said, "Well, we've currently only spent about 70 million. The assets here are 125 million. So I said, I can't make that kind of profit in the next 5 years to 10 years. I really don't think I can. So I would take it. GMG, for whatever reason, decided to ask Chrysalis for another 5 million. I mean, why we were asking for another 5 million, I've no idea. I remember having to ring Phil Riley and I said, "Phil, great news, we're happy to sell to you." And he went, "That's fantastic, John, fantastic." I said, "But I'm afraid it has to be 130. And he said to me, "Well, what's the reason for another 5 million?" I said, "I don't know." To be honest, Phil, I don't know. Anyway, Chris Wright and Chrysalis Board rejected that, so we didn't go ahead with the deal, which I thought was a bad error. And at the following board meeting, they said, "Well, John, we haven't got a buyer. What are we going to do?" And I said, "Well, if you're going to stay in radio, you actually have to become bigger. You've got to become one of the top three." Radio stations were merging, groups were getting bigger, and it was all about the share of the advertising cake. And at that time, Capital and Ralph Bernard had acquired the Century stations. I wanted to get the Century stations back because we could turn them into Century or Real Radio or whatever. Negotiating with Ralph Bernard is like trying to juggle jelly. You think you've got it, but it was the most torturous negotiation ever. But I knew deep down, and he'd slipped it to me a couple of weeks earlier, he had no love of Chrysalis. He did not want to sell the Century brand to Chrysalis because that made Chrysalis bigger and a much bigger competitor. He wanted to sell to us, and the conversations went on and on and on. And eventually, we bought the two Century stations back, the Northwest and the one in Newcastle. We bought them for £60 million. And at that point, Chrysalis had nowhere to go. They had to be sellers. And GMG was the biggest stations. I wasn't emotional about it or anything like that. It was just a business deal. And sadly, I don't know why, that's just the way it was. But I know at that time, it was great to have them back. And it was great to be working with those people again. And then I could see things were happening at GMG. The writing was on the wall. They wanted to do other things. Sir Bob Phillips had passed away. Carolyn McCall came in. She was a great boss, by the way. Carolyn McCall, no wonder she's so good at EasyJet. Great boss. But I just thought, I'd done 10 years. I was about to hit my 50th birthday, and I left on exactly my 50th birthday, and I decided to retire. And since I've retired, I then, of course, did the Myers reports for the government and the BBC. I think there's a way of doing things. I think all the reports I've done, whether it's for the digital report in Britain or whether it's for the report on the BBCs and particular BBC local radio, I just tell it as I see it. You know, I'm not after a job. I don't want to join them full time, but I will be honest with my views as I see it. I don't have the monopoly on being right, but they've hired me to give a view. And that view is exactly where I believe it to be. I think that joining the establishment is something that would fill me with shock and horror. And the problem is, I don't trust myself sometimes to be serious all the time. So sometimes in meetings, I find myself looking for the one-liner or something to break the ice because the monotony of it all. I love management because I found a way of connecting with the staff and making them be as good as they can be. My PA used to complain that I would come into the building and it would take me half an hour to get to my office because I'd go on the programme floor first, then I'd go on the sales floor, and by the time I got to the office, it might be an hour, 2 hours later. So I found a way of making sure that the staff were motivated and were encouraged to do what they can do. And I love doing the deals. I think now what I miss, apart from the people, is I miss doing something that makes a difference, that creates change. I haven't got it now, so that's what I miss. I certainly miss the exciting moments, but I don't actually miss radio. I think radio has changed to a point where it's still very successful, but I'm sure that if I got into radio now again, I'm not so sure it would be as exciting as it was when I was going through the 80s and the 90s and the noughties. One of the things that I'm very proud of is that my closest people in management, my management team, tended to follow me from one company to another. None of them were shorter than 10 years. Some of them were 20 years. With that becomes an understanding and a way of doing things. I used to encourage craziness, do things different, make me laugh. You want people to be different. You want people to try new things, but you have to trust them. You want them to be loyal. So very often, my management team, they would get offers from other companies for more money, but they wouldn't go, which is, I think, to everyone's credit. So loyalty is important. Trusting the people is important. But you have to work with people you like. And I never work with anyone I don't like. So even if you're super talented, if I don't like it, I don't want to work with you, because I'm going to spend too much of my life with you. My family's been the reason I've been allowed to do what I do in radio. Linda, who just celebrated 31 years this last couple of weeks, is always by my side. She loves radio, she loves getting involved, and she loves talking to the staff and making a fuss of them. My son, Scott, he was in radio, and I remember when he said, "Dad, I want to get in radio." And I said, "Well, you're not coming to work for me." And he says, "Where can I work?" And I said, "Well, look," I said, "I want you to work with people where you will learn different things to what I might teach you." And we sent him to work to, he went to university in Leeds. And I think, David, you are the person he came to work with, my memory serves me right. He came to Leeds and worked at Galaxy. And he absolutely loved it. Dropped out of university, so I blame you for that. Dropped out of uni and got into radio and loved Galaxy. Loved Galaxy, which was then Capital, of course, and went on to be the breakfast producer. And now he's running his own business, MRA Digital. And he does a lot of the websites now and the apps and everything else digital for so many of the radio stations around the UK and abroad. And my daughter, Kerry, she's got her own business as well, and she's very successful at what she does, not in radio, but in the inventory side of homes. So it's great to have a family that does their own thing. And it's great to be here just guiding them in the right direction, as so many people have guided me. I think at the end, when someone's looking down and someone says, "John Myers, what did you think?" I think if people said, "He made a difference and he was a nice guy," I think that I think that's the best anyone can hope for.
The broadcaster and radio executive John Myers has died at the age of 60. He began his career at BBC Radio Cumbria in 1980 and became a popular voice on commercial radio in the north of England, presenting under the name John Morgan. He went on to run The Guardian's radio division and led a government-backed review of the industry in 2009.
Well, I suppose the manner of his going on the 18th at Glen Eagles is typical of John as a guy. He was brilliant at so many things, and as a radio professional, he was undoubtedly brilliant at back timing, and that's how we'll remember him.
John absolutely understood what his audience would accept, what they wouldn't accept, and it was the same for all the businesses that he touched.
I've known John many years. I got to know him really well when I was running Radio 4. He was an extraordinary figure because although most of his life was defined by commercial radio, actually slightly rose above the fray.
Whenever the audience figures came out, John and Linda would throw a party at their home up in Garstang.
John was one of a kind. He was generous with his time, whether you worked for him or not, whether you were on the air or just starting out in radio.
This is Andrew Harrison, Chief Executive of Radio Centre for its first 7 years, at a time when John was a founding board member. He treated everything in life with great optimism, great verve for life.
This is John Holmes. Memories of John Myers. He always used to send me
send me a personal message after I had, let's say, a career blip.
John Myers. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.